Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Angela Heathcote, and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. This episode, I'm talking to Leslie Hughes. Leslie has been described as a rock star of climate change science. She's been on the forefront of educating Australians about the impacts of climate change. She's also been fired twice directly by the government, which is something a lot of us can't say about ourselves. She's currently working for the Climate Council, and I'm super excited to be sitting down with her today for this episode of Talking Australia. Leslie, thank you so much for being with me today.
It's a pleasure.
Now, you have one of the most interesting scientific careers I know of, in that you went from studying biology and then you made that transition to climate change science. Can you tell me a little bit about that? And, you know, was that a difficult transition for you?
No, it wasn't really a difficult transition. So, as you say, I started as a biologist. I have a Bachelor of Science degree from University of Sydney. And I was motivated to do that because I was always interested in animals. I wanted to do zoology. I was one of these kids that grew up mostly in the bush, catching lizards, watching birds, you know, keeping beetles in jars, that sort of thing. So it was a natural transition to do a zoology and ecology-based science degree. I then went to do a PhD at Macquarie University, and I realised that I really liked doing experiments, manipulative experiments. So I did a PhD using ants because, of course, ants are much more easy to manipulate than lots of other, what I would have thought of more interesting animals at the time, though I certainly became fascinated by ants. So I spent the 4 years of my PhD following ants around the bush, basically. And then I got to the end of that and thought, I've really got to do something different. And this was in the sort of late 80s, early 90s. And I had a talk with my PhD supervisor at the time, who said, oh, look, you know, what about doing something on climate change? And I had honestly never thought about climate change before that. I mean, climate change back in 1990 was not the topic that it is now.
What did you think when she said that to you?
Well, it was he, but I thought, oh, well, I had sort of more mercenary thoughts, I suppose, because when you get to the end of a PhD, the main thing in your mind is getting a job. And I thought, well, climate change is clearly a future issue that's going to be more important. And it's an applied issue rather than a more fundamental science issue of following ants around the bush and figuring out what they're doing. And I honestly thought, well, maybe I've got a better chance of getting a job and getting money and getting writing a postdoc proposal and getting somebody to fund that if it's on a topic like climate change. So I guess I got into climate change for somewhat practical, somewhat mercenary reasons.
And then how did that develop?
Well, I started, I did a postdoc in Queensland doing a big transplant experiment. I liked being in the field and I thought, well, I'll do a transplant experiment where I would take plants from one part of the country and transplant them into a climate that they might experience in the future and basically to see what might happen.
And what year were you doing this?
That was in the early 90s.
That's pretty forward research.
I guess so. I mean, in some ways, I was really lucky in that there were very few people in Australia or globally really doing climate change work.
Is that weird? Because I guess it was like this. It was oncoming.
It was still new. It was still new. I mean, most of the research was being done on the climate side rather than on the impact side. And I was getting interested in, well, okay, we're finding out what might happen to the climate in the future, but what are the impacts going to be on species and ecosystems? At the time, there were so few people working in that area that I could easily keep up with all of the literature in that area, you know, which is completely impossible these days. In fact, a few years after that, a colleague and I organised the very first workshop in Australia on climate impacts on biodiversity. And we had about 20 people in the room, and that was basically it for Australia. So I think I was lucky getting into the area that became very popular later, but I got into it where it was kind of empty, a lot of empty niches.
So you didn't expect it to be kind of as, I guess, dark as it turned out to be?
Look, I probably didn't even think about it like that. You know, it was more of an interesting intellectual problem at that point, you know, the traditional academic problem. I don't think I really... I certainly didn't think back then that it was going to be a catastrophic issue the way I think about it now. You know, that's been a slowly growing but accelerating realisation over the subsequent 20 plus years.
And you wrote a fantastic article for The Monthly titled When Planetary Catastrophe is Your Day Job. And in it you talked about, you know, how to balance motivation and despair. I guess I was wondering, I mean, how do you do that from day to day? What does your day to day look like when you're dealing with these figures and these stats on a daily basis? You're always talking about it.
Some days it's easier than others. I think all of us that work on an issue like this, and it's probably the same with people that work on refugee problems and other sort of major social or environmental or political problems, you can't think about it all the time or you go nuts. And you'd become so depressed that you wouldn't be able to function. So I think we all get quite good at sort of petitioning our minds so that, you know, when I'm thinking climate change, I'm really thinking climate change. But at other times of the day or the week or the weekend, I'm thinking about other things. So, you know, there are plenty of other things I like to do with my time. I love to travel. I like gardening. I like cooking. I like reading. All of those things. I do all those things. And when I'm doing those things, I'm switched off from thinking about climate change.
Mm. And you mentioned, obviously, there are those terrible moments. I mean, is there kind of a standout moment for you that was like, wow, this is really rock bottom? I'm feeling, you know, the pressure. I'm feeling anxiety about having to do this every day.
It's hard to say. I think because I've been in it so long, there's been a gradual process. You know, I don't think I've ever had the light bulb moment that some people have had when they've woken up and something's happened and they've all of a sudden thought, oh my God, this really is serious. I think for me, because I started so long ago, it's been an ongoing gradual realization of how serious it could be. And that continues and accelerates because the changes we're seeing in the climate is accelerating, and it's very clear now that the science is telling us that we are getting closer and closer to some pretty disastrous tipping points, and that of course is an enormous concern.
And you've worked on a lot of assessments for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a UN body, and they released quite a damning report, I think it was last year.
Yep.
I mean, can you kind of tell us what that told us, and I mean, where are Australia at in that context?
Yeah. So the report last year from the IPCC was basically about what the world would be like if we get to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. We're already at about 1 degree or a little bit over 1 degree. And it contrasted the 1.5 degree scenario for a whole lot of different sectors with the 2 degree scenario. And they took those two figures from the Paris Climate Agreement, because the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015 basically embodied the target, the ambition of not going over 2 degrees, and the aspiration of not going over 1.5 degrees. So following on from that, the IPCC basically asked the question, okay, well, what will the world be like at 1.5 compared to now and 1.5 compared to 2? And the basic story that comes out of that report is, and it's different between different sectors, but the overall message is that 2 degrees is a hell of a lot worse than 1.5. It's not a linear process where 2 degrees is twice as bad as 1 degree. It's more of an exponential process in many sectors where 2 degrees is a hell of a lot more than twice as bad as 1 degree. And it's really, the whole report, I think, is aimed at saying, if we can keep to 1.5, then we will hopefully avoid all of those really even much worse impacts than at 2, even though 1.5 is going to be bad enough.
We'll take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment with Leslie Hughes. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. We're back with our conversation with Leslie Hughes. You work for the Climate Council, which I guess has a very, very colourful history in terms of, climate science, obviously, and also Australian political life. I was hoping, and you've been there from the beginning, so I just wanted you to take me through that colourful history.
Yeah, it's been a wild ride. So it actually began with a different organisation, the Climate Commission. So when Julia Gillard became Prime Minister, she had a hung parliament. And that allowed the Greens and some of the independents to actually have quite a bit of influence on climate policy that they may not have had if either Labor or the coalition had got in with a majority. So as part of that, it was when the carbon price was settled. There was a multi-party committee that settled on having a carbon price with a transition to an emissions reduction scheme some years later. As part of that package, they realised that they needed people to communicate to the Australian public what climate change was all about, what the implications of a carbon price might be, what the risks to different sectors might be. So they set up the Climate Commission as a communication body with the mandate to get out and about in the community and answer questions and tell people about those things. So they asked six people from a range of backgrounds. Tim Flannery was first asked to be the chief commissioner, and then he asked Will Steffen to come on board. Will then suggested I come on board, et cetera, until there was a body of six of us that joined. And we spent the next 2.5 years going around the country. We did literally town hall meetings in town halls, but also RSL clubs and theatres and all sorts of things.
Was that a very interesting experience?
It was an amazing experience. The very first one that we did, which was in a very toxic political environment when Tony Abbott was really stirring up trouble and demonstrations on the lawns of Parliament about the carbon, the big new tax and all of that sort of thing. Our first town hall was in Geelong. We deliberately went to Geelong because at the time it was the most carbon intensive city in Australia. So we thought, well, if anybody is going to be affected, any place is going to be affected by a carbon price, it's going to be Geelong, so we're just going to go into the jaws of the lion sort of thing. So we were in the Geelong Town Hall, there were 500 people, it was standing room only, we had plainclothes security people everywhere because there were demonstrations outside, you know, it was very, very tense.
Wow.
We hardly knew each other. We had no idea how it was going to go. We were up on the stage and we were there for 2 hours. It was being filmed live on Sky and ABC News. It was really full on. We had these huge hot lights in our faces and we just took questions, you know. Anyway, after, you know, we lived through it. Afterwards, we went back to our hotel and had a stiff couple of drinks. And after about the third drink, we thought, oh, well, it wasn't too bad. You know, we'll do it again. So over the next 2.5 years, we did that about 30 times. And we also wrote reports and we did lots of media and all of that sort of thing, supported by the Department of Climate Change and the minister, who was Greg Combey at the time. Then, of course, the government changed. Tony Abbott came in. We were pre-warned that the commission would be abolished. He'd told us, or rather Greg Hunt, who was the incoming minister, told us that if they got into government, they would abolish the commission.
They said it straight to you.
Oh, yes. So we knew. So about probably 6 months before the election, Tim got us all together in a hotel room in Melbourne and said, look, if we can raise the money, would you be prepared to keep going in a sort of more private capacity if the commission gets abolished? And we all said, yes, we would. We knew our job wasn't finished. So we started to put together a business plan for it, started talking to some philanthropists and sort of setting up a fundraising plan, but we still didn't know if it would be remotely successful. then the election came and Abbott abolishing the commission was the first act of the Abbott government. So the election was on the Saturday. The government was sworn in, I think, the week later, and on the second day of the government, we were abolished. So
wow. Do you know, actually, how someone described me to you, described you to me once was, you've got to know about this rock star scientist. She was like the first scientist fired by the government. It's amazing.
Right. I was actually fired twice. I was on another committee. I got two Dear Leslie letters from Greg Hunt in about the same week. So I felt like sort of making a T-shirt or something. Anyway... We had this plan ready to go. So about 10 days after that, Tim went on the ABC Late Line and said, all right, we're setting up this new body. It's going to be called the Climate Council. We'd trademarked, you know, we'd registered the name. We'd really like people to fund us. And our website is open from midnight tonight, you know, please.
How did you feel when that commission was just done? I mean, surely
look, even though we knew it was going to happen, when it finally happened, it was still a shock. You know, I think part of me just thought they won't do it. And then, so when they did do it, you know, it was like grieving, you know. But having had a plan to go ahead, even though we didn't know if it would work or not, at least gave us something to look forward to. So, it was the most amazing thing. So the first donation, which was about $15 from some guy, came in at a minute past midnight. And by that afternoon, we'd raised over $200,000 and we raised $1.2 million in a week. And I think what happened was that the population that were already on side was so pissed off that, firstly, that Abbott had got in and that their first act was to destroy an organisation that was about communicating science. And to, I think, a lot of people in the Australian public, that symbolised everything that they'd been worried about that government getting in. And the way they expressed that anger and frustration was to send us money. So we gave them an outlet as a tangible, you know, they were so frustrated and so angry, and the only thing they could do was actually send money. So we raised $1.2 million in that first week. Then, of course, the panic set in, because then we had this incredible responsibility of all the hopes of all of these people that had donated money. And we thought, well, what are we going to give them now? You know, we have no staff. At that point, we didn't have an office. We've got to start producing content. We had a website, and that was it. So the very first thing, you know, that was in the September, and we were coming up to what was going to be a pretty hot summer. And we got together and I said, look, it's going to be a bad bushfire season this summer. I think our first report should be on bushfires. That's the first of about a dozen reports I've written on bushfires. So I started putting together the literature on the bushfire situation and climate change. And as I was writing that report, it was October and the Blue Mountains bushfires happened, 200 homes lost. And I was frantically trying to get this report finished as all these reports of the bushfires were coming in and getting rung up by journalists saying, well, can you send us something about bushfires? So it's funny, we put together a one-page dot, you know, 10 in 10 minutes, a sort of press release with dot points about the relationship of climate change and bushfires, and had a huge interest in the media. And in fact, it was more than in the final report, which was 100 pages with, you know, 500 references or something. So that kind of got us going. We had an office donated to us. We had office furniture donated. We had people ringing up wanting to help donate photos, all of those sorts of things.
So there was this sense that you guys were wanted.
Yeah, well, I guess they wouldn't have given us money otherwise, you know, but we did feel that pressure of expectation that we had this responsibility and these expectations riding on us. We had to start producing stuff. So we were pretty frantic to get some content out there.
Mm. One thing I found really interesting, we interviewed Tim Flannery for this podcast a little while ago, and he mentioned that while he was a climate commissioner, he had the AFP guarding his home for a period of time.
Yeah.
And I know that, I guess, climate change has kind of gone into these often, you know, right-wing kind of, it's become quite a right-wing talking point.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering, have you ever felt worried as a prominent voice on climate change in Australia? Have you ever been concerned for your own safety?
Look, not really. I think Tim was always the big target. You know, he'd already attracted the ire of that right-wing element. Certainly some of the right-wing radio commentators, shock jocks, you know, and it got pretty personal. Tim has and probably possibly still has death threats from time to time. I've never received anything much like that. I've had some pretty nasty messages left on my voicemail, for example, but that's about as far as it's gone. I actually think that being a woman is sort of somewhat protective of that. You know, I think men get more of that. Certainly Tim's had to put up with awful things. When we did join the commission, however, you know, we had a lecture from the AFP and we all had an emergency phone number in our phones that it was a 24-hour security number, and they said if you ever feel physically threatened for any reason, call this number and, you know, somebody will turn up at your door, you know, within minutes sort of thing. So that was kind of, it was a little bit scary that they felt that we needed that, but it was also reassuring that we actually had that backup. Fortunately, I don't think any of us ever had to initiate that.
Well, that's good to hear.
We certainly had security, plainclothes security at all of our town hall meetings. Usually we wouldn't even know who they were. I remember once sort of pointing out a couple of disheveled looking guys that looked a bit suspicious to one of our organisers, and I said, you know, those guys look a bit dodgy, and they said, yeah, they're the plainclothes detectives, so don't worry about it. So it was usually the most shifty looking guys were actually
they
the
were
security
not fitting
guys
in.
yeah.
And you've, like you said, you've been studying and researching and doing all these things around climate change since the 80s, and so you would be quite privy to how the debate has changed over that time, in that it began as this scientific debate, and it's kind of turned into this, you know, enormous beast in that, you know, comes off in all different ways. I mean, could you kind of, you know, talk about that change in the debate or the so-called debate, and what it's like now, where it's at now?
Yeah. So, I mean, you're right. It really was all about science, you know, for a long time, certainly in Australia. And then it was only as time went on, when people started to realise that certain things would have to be given up in order to get the climate under control. You know, we had to stop emitting fossil fuel emissions. And Australia, of course, is in a fairly unique position in that coal has always been an enormous part of our economy. You know, it's second or third biggest earner of export dollars, remains that to this day. There was a recent report put out by the Australia Institute noting that, in fact, Australia is the third greatest exporter of fossil fuels in the world after Saudi Arabia and some other country. So, you know, in Australia, fossil fuels have been a big part of our economy. So in that sense, it's quite understandable that as that money train started to be threatened, that people would respond to that in a negative way. And one of the ways they have responded to that at times has been to attack the messengers, and we're all the messengers.
Mm. And I wanted to bring up, I guess, one of the conversations that we're having about climate change recently. I think maybe 2 years ago, The Guardian published an article that basically said, you know, X amount of corporations are responsible for climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we putting the onus on the individual to make all these small changes in their life? And I'm really curious about what you think about that debate when it comes to the responsibility of the individual versus the responsibility of corporations.
Well, for me, it's very simple. It's everything. I mean, yes, there are the corporations that physically burn the coal to produce the electricity, but you and I use the electricity. So, you know, in one sense, it's unfair to talk about the big polluters in some way, because those big polluters are producing a product that we're all buying. So I don't think we can sheet home the blame to this corporation or that corporation or this individual or that individual. It's how our society, how our lives run. So the onus is on, certainly on individuals, and certainly on corporations, but not one or the other.
And are there things in your own life as a climate change scientist? I'm very curious about what things you employ, in your own life that are that make, I guess, that are more climate friendly.
Yeah. Well, I have solar panels on my roof. You know, I'm not a vegetarian, but I eat a lot less meat than I used to. But I'm certainly not perfect either. You know, I still drive a car when I need to. You know, I try to use public transport and walk, etc. When I can. You know, I take flights, but I try to offset buy offsets when I do that. So, you know, I'm like lots of people, really, trying to do my bit. But I guess I feel that the skills that I have and the experience and the expertise and perhaps the reputation I have, my way of dealing with climate change is to do what I can professionally as a communicator and a researcher.
And I wanted to go back to what you mentioned about, you know, when the Climate Commission was, you know, travelling around Australia and giving these public talks. And you mentioned you went into Geelong, which is, you know, ultimate coal country.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, what methods do you find work when you talk to people that are in coal country or just people who are, climate deniers or maybe sitting on the fence and don't understand?
Mm.
What convinces them that, you know, climate change is this enormously important issue?
Mm. Well, look, it's different things for different people. I mean, if we had the answer to that question, we wouldn't be where we are now. And in fact, you know, when I get together with my Climate Council colleagues, you know, that's our main topic of conversation. How do we deliver this message to get effective action? In fact, I spent 2 days ago a full day with the council, you know, thinking about our strategy going forward. One of the biggest successes I've had, I suppose, is thinking and talking to people about their children's future. Because I think that for most people are motivated by two things. They're the people that they love and their sense of security, especially financial security. So if you can talk about those things, I think that gets effective cut through. One of the most successful, I think, communication tools that I've ever come up with, I sort of came up with on the spur of the moment, which was a graph that I showed as a slide. And as a scientist, of course, I love graphs. You know, they're my tools of trade, are graphs. But I realised very quickly when we're on the Climate Commission and going around and giving sort of short slide presentations that you put up the first graph and you immediately see the eyes glaze over, because people who aren't scientists and aren't used to dealing with that sort of two-dimensional representation of data, it just shuts people down. They don't understand how to interpret it, and they're just not interested. It's a huge barrier. So I was sort of sitting puzzling one day just before we were about to go on the stage, thinking, how can I get across that this graph is so explosive in what it's telling you? So as an experiment, I put on this graph, which was of future climate potentially under different scenarios, and I put on, okay, well, let's put on my own potential lifespan at a level of average temperature that I will experience. And what about I've got two kids born in the mid-90s. What about their lifespan? What's the average temperature that they will experience? And then my hypothetical grandchildren, which I don't have yet, but if my kids have kids when they're about 30, what would my kids, they'll live through into the next century if they live till they're 85. So I put up this graph then, just the standard graph, and then put these three bars on it of me and my average temperature, my kids' temperature, and my hypothetical grandkids' temperature. And that was in a regional centre. I don't even remember where it was. And afterwards, this woman came up, because we would always sort of go down into the audience and chat with the audience after and have a cup of tea and that sort of thing. I always really enjoyed that. And this woman came up to me and she said, I burst into tears when you did that, because it suddenly seemed real to me. And I thought, well, that's, you know, I didn't mean for anybody to cry, but I knew I had something then, because I knew I could use that to translate this really boring scientific looking graph into something that at least some people would connect with emotionally. And I actually think, you know, we talk about scientists having to be terribly objective and, you know, almost like automatons. But actually, if you want people to act and to care, you've actually got to you've got to get to them emotionally, and this was a way perhaps of doing it.
Mm.
So that's, you know, over the years I've shown that graph many, many times, and other people have written to me and said, oh, can I have a copy of that graph because I want to show it, and it's become known as Leslie's grandkids graph, which is ironic because I don't have any grandkids. But
do your kids feel pressured by this graph?
Yeah, maybe. I don't show them generally, but I think we've got to think about communicating as scientists in ways to people who are not scientists, in using methods that actually get to the things they really care about.
Right. And my last question, Leslie, you and a lot of other scientists, along with international bodies, have criticised Australia's approach to tackling the issue of climate change. Given all that you know there is to do, do you feel you're genuinely optimistic about our future?
Whether I feel optimistic or not depends entirely on the day. There are some days, you know, I'll hear something about great new technology or somebody make a great statement, and then other days I'll just read the headlines or listen to the news when I get up and feel, oh my God, you know. So it's mixed. I can't say I always feel pessimistic or always feel optimistic. It's a real mixture. One of the quotes that I use in that monthly article that you mentioned earlier was something that I think really captures that, which is a quote from a Marxist politician in the 19th century, Antonio Gramsci, who talked about the tension between the pessimism of the intellect and the optimism of the will. And I actually think, to me, that captures how we think about climate change. You know, at one level, you know the facts, and the facts are bad. There's no sugarcoating that. The facts indicate to us that we're heading to fall off a pretty big cliff. On the other hand, the natural human optimism of being hopeful and therefore working hard towards a better future has got to balance that. And I've come to the conclusion after all of this time that we must be hopeful, we must have optimism, and rather than thinking of those things as just an emotion, I think of them as a strategy. So hope for me is a strategy, because if you don't have hope, then you give up. And if you give up, well, it is hopeless. So for me, hope is a tool that we need to employ.
Well, that's a really lovely note to end on. Thank you so much for chatting with me today, Leslie.
Thanks, Angela.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia with Leslie Hughes. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.